Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we interview some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I had just designed Vong for Jean-Georges Vongerichten, which was Thai, and Drew, in a moment of typecasting, said...
Oh, you're the Asian food guy.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want it to look like Vong. And I said, well, that's not a problem. Not a problem.
Today we have architectural and design visionary David Rockwell in the house. David and his talented team at the Rockwell Group design everything from restaurants like the Nobus all over the world, hotels, the auditorium where they hold the Academy Awards. You name it, they do it. You want food cred? He's a member of Who's Who in Food and Beverage in America. As a set designer, he's won a Tony for She Loves Me and has designed sets for shows as varied as Kinky Boots, The Normal Heart, and Shakespeare in the Park. Welcome to Special Sauce, the most thoughtful and imaginative visual person I know, Mr. David Rockwell.
Thank you, Ed. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's so great to have you. We have so many things I want to discuss.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. Yeah. David was one of the first people I pitched the idea of Serious Eats to, right? I came up to your office on Union Square. Do you still have that office?
I still do, yeah. And look at how Union Square has totally transformed since then. Right?
It's crazy.
It is
amazing. And you were involved in some of the transformation.
We were certainly early adapters.
Yeah. First of all, tell us about life at the Rockwell family table growing up.
I am the youngest of five boys, and we moved around a lot. So life at the family table was, in some ways... dining was a competitive art form, given that...
five boys. I'm one of four boys. I think you and I have discussed this. And my mother always used to get nine pork chops. It was like, okay, who can eat the fastest to get the third pork chop?
Exactly. Where are you in the age range?
I'm the youngest.
I'm the youngest, too.
Yeah.
So dining was, very energetic, full contact sport around our dining room table growing up.
And was your mom doing the cooking?
She did some of the cooking. She was really the dessert person.
She was the pastry chef.
She was the pastry chef, yeah.
And so was there a housekeeper or did everyone pitch in?
Well, we moved around a lot. I think I mentioned this before, but we lived in Chicago early on, moved when I was three to the Jersey Shore.
Right, to Deal, right?
Well, first to Morristown, to Mendham, and then to Deal. And my memory of meals in Deal was mostly around summers, and it was mostly kind of informal friends coming over with everyone pitching in. We then moved when I was 12 to Mexico, to Guadalajara, Mexico.
Man, that's not like moving from Jersey to Westchester.
It is truly, if you took Deal, New Jersey, which is all about private homes— and turned it inside out, you would get Guadalajara, Mexico. But as a 12-year-old, that was, in retrospect, it's not something you're aware of then, but an extraordinarily powerful experience for me in what's sort of drives me creatively. And that's curiosity about a new culture. Everything about it was different. In fact, it's where I fell in love with street food and... one of the things I remember most about Guadalajara that still is striking to this day is on Sundays we would go with the woman who was our housekeeper, would take my brothers and I to a little place outside of Tlaquepaque and eat pozole that this person would make only on Sundays. So they would set up tables.
It's traditionally a weekend-only dish, right? In Mexican restaurants all over this country, at least.
So I guess the net sum of those experiences around dining made me start to think about special occasion and food as a way to kind of bring people together for a special occasion.
What were the circumstances that led to your moving from Chicago to New Jersey? Your dad died, if I remember.
When I was two in a plane crash in, in two and a half in 59. And my mom, who had five boys, fell in love quickly with a guy named John Rockwell. And John, to me was my father. He's really the one who raised us. But he adopted five boys, a very brave man.
And he deserved a Congressional Medal of Honor for that.
And so we sort of picked up the theater troupe and moved to New Jersey because his business was back in New Jersey. And then we were spending summers in Deal, and he bought a house there. It is in fact where my mom, who had been a dancer in vaudeville, she had long since stopped doing that, but she helped to found a community theater there called the Deal Players that is literally one step away from Waiting for Guffman.
Really?
Oh, it was totally full on Guffman, where the local dentist was the man, the music man. But it took this town, and for 2 or 3 months, it transformed it. I guess it was really for 2 months for there was sort of the rehearsals and the building of the set. But it permeated into the town in so many incredible ways. And since my mom was involved, all of us were involved one way or another in my family, either making things or badly playing the kids in the band or whatever it was. And that's where I started to develop this kind of fascination and love of visual storytelling and theater.
Interesting. But was that preceded by a love of food and restaurants, or did really that visual thing first come into play in your life with theater?
I think design first came into my life as a way to moderate and deal with transitions that were happening to me that I wasn't able to control. Loss of a dad, you know, and again, this is all in retrospect, but loss of a dad, lots of movement to different places. And I was always building things. I was one of those kids who we had a garage, and that was my sort of laboratory where we would build spook houses or holiday festivals or take boxes and make villages. And
you were probably really good at Legos.
I was really good at Legos. Although back then, you know, it was really more Lincoln Logs, I think. Not to date myself.
But right. It's true. It's true.
I have a 17-year-old son, and when he was 7 or 8, I would get these insanely complicated Lego sets. And my wife would remind me, those Lego sets are supposed to be for Sam. Is that building like? So design started out as a way to mediate the world and communicate. And so it was really very much about building things. And then the interest in restaurants really was triggered by a couple of things. The decision to move to Mexico was very sudden in terms of how it was communicated to us. I don't know how long my mom and dad had been talking about it, but it was announced he was selling his business and we were going to get in the station wagon and drive to Guadalajara, Mexico, which was surreal, you know, and amazing. And when you drive through Mexico to get to Guadalajara, you drive through the Barranca, which is the Mexican Grand Canyon. And as you see signs about how far things are, they have to be as the crow flies, because it will say, you know, 10 kilometers, and then you drive for 3 hours, and it'll say 8 kilometers.
Right.
So we finally got there, 8,000 feet above sea level. The dogs were all on the roofs for protection. No one spoke English. So for a 12-year-old, it was really like landing in Oz, where everyone spoke a different language.
Right, or the moon.
But dining was a much bigger part of the culture there, as was street life, marketplaces. The marketplace in Guadalajara is an extraordinary market. So I spent a lot of my free time sort of rattling around a lot of the open spaces and plazas in Guadalajara.
Interesting. And was your stepfather interested in food?
No, my mom was interested in celebration. So,
which is what she gave to you, is a desire to create places where celebrations can take place.
Where connections happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You then went to Syracuse, right?
Yeah.
And you studied design and architecture, right? Was it with the idea that you would design restaurants? Like, how did that happen?
Well, every summer in architecture school in Syracuse, I would come to New York and got a range of different jobs.
Like internships, essentially.
Internships, right. And then I did a year abroad at the Architectural Association, came back to New York for the summer, and had seen a Broadway production of a show called Dracula, starring Frank Langella.
Langella, sure.
And the sets were by—
I'm old enough to remember that.
Do you remember the sets? They were by Edward Gorey, the illustrator. And so I cold called the lighting designer. A friend of mine named Jules Fisher, who's a—
Yeah, famous lighting designer.
Legendary lighting designer.
Rock and roll lighting designer.
Yeah, and I met him when I was in college doing research. I reached out to him, and we became friends when I was 19. I said, I just saw Dracula, and I'd like to see if I could work for the lighting designer. He gave me the name. I cold called Roger Morgan and got a job working as a theater consultant, meaning when an architect is doing a theater, they want to have someone on board who understands a little bit about the parameters of theater. So I was a draftsman for him. So I had these various jobs. When I finished school, again, did several jobs. And the last job before I started to really dive into restaurants was working for a man named John Stork, who is a recording studio designer, extraordinarily successful recording studio designer. He had a project called the Wild. It was actually going to be the Crazy Horse Saloon from Paris, which, you know, is a sort of avant-garde strip club is really what it is. And they were coming to New York, and he said, David, you could be the project architect. I was 24 or something like that.
Wow.
So I flew to Paris to look at the Crazy Horse, came back, and started designing a place on West 54th Street that was going to be the Crazy Horse Saloon. They lost the license, so it became the bootleg Crazy Horse Saloon called the Wildcat Saloon. And it opened up. It was a beautiful showroom. The show was so awful. So I sat there opening night having a couple of drinks. And
come on, you probably had more than a couple of drinks.
Yeah, I wasn't counting back then.
Right.
And I met someone who was looking to do a restaurant. And that's so the first restaurant opportunity came about from someone seeing work I had done. And it was for a renovation of Le Perigord, which just closed.
Right.
And
it was East Side, old school French restaurant.
Georges Breguet was the maitre d' up until the time they closed it. I guess the owner, too. But anyway, he needed to renovate it. He had an event there in 6 weeks. And could we design and renovate a restaurant in 6 weeks? I said, sure. And we brought in a shop to work 24 hours a day, different shifts. And that then opened up an opportunity for the second restaurant, which was Sushi Zen, the original Sushi Zen on 46th Street. And he, of course, became a legendary and still is a legendary chef. So the restaurants didn't come about through any kind of linear, I'm interested in restaurants.
Right.
It came about through being interested in places where people come together. And I think that's still the thing to this day that interests me most about restaurants is how is
how do people connect in a space?
Yeah. And I think New York is a place that when you think about it architecturally, you think about tall buildings and you think about it, how neat it looks from the air. And I'm much more interested in kind of the messiness that happens at street level.
And that means it was easy for you to spread your wings to doing projects outside New York.
That's right. Yeah. And I found the best opportunities, just like those early restaurants, come from just putting yourself out there and pursuing the things that you love. And now when people work for me, the thing I encourage them to do is find those things that they're interested in. What are those design elements? Not worry about what the project type is, but focus on what it is you want to make happen.
How did your thinking evolve along those lines? Did you learn it from professors? Did you connect the dots in an original way yourself?
Oh, God.
Sorry, I got to ask the tough questions.
It's an essay question. I think the closest thing I can give you an answer to that is I was fortunate enough and have been fortunate enough to not have the eccentric edges of what I was interested in rubbed off in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there's a tendency to you want to conform or have a notion of what design is or architecture is. And I think I found, in some ways it was lucky and persistent and flexibility. But it also, things make much more sense in the rearview mirror as you're looking back and seeing how things happened. I believe the challenge and the part about it that's been successful for me is not defining what I do in a particular box, not buying into that, continuing to find new opportunities where I don't know the answer before I begin.
Right.
I think that is the trap is, trying to do things where you're an expert as opposed to gather all the tools that you need. When I started working in theater, I had spent many years meeting with directors, designing for free, sketching before I took the opportunity to really do that. So I think it, you know, you need the tools, but then you need the way to look at the world in a different way that's not a predetermined solution.
I'm interested in how you avoid it, because architecture is all about those boxes you're talking about. But it sounds like you sort of skipped that step.
No, I didn't skip that step. I mean, I think you have to be a student of the world around you. And I remember one piece of advice I was given really early on when I was working for another architect is to have a tape measure with me. And when you're in a place you find interesting, start to measure dimensions and start to understand, you know, what is personal space, what is public space, try and get a sense of that. So I think you have to be a student of the work you're doing and look at everything going on in and around that world. The research piece is true, and the way I defined it early on, before doing any work really in the theater, was we were extracting a script. So when we started working with Nobu 24 years ago, I started by tasting his food and by talking to him about his approach to the food. And there were certain things that emerged that were very influential in the design of that. One of them, for instance, was his fusion of South American taste with Japanese sushi mastery.
Right, and he had restaurants and worked in restaurants in Peru, correct?
He worked in Peru, and then he moved to L.A. He came to L.A. That's when he opened
Matsuhisa. Right.
So I went out and ate at Matsuhisa. Now, the way I got that job was interesting in that we were designing for Meals on Wheels something at the South Street Seaport called the Feast of the Many Moons.
Mm-hmm.
Great Asian chefs from around the world. Nobu had not come to New York yet, and I was on a ladder lashing together these internally lit moons. And, you know, in my world, those were the most important things. Get the moons right, and the festival will be good.
Right.
And you have to – I do believe you have to have that life or death scenario in your work, because you do want to create that perfect object in that perfect environment.
But it means you can't be afraid to take risks.
You cannot be afraid to take risks. You cannot be afraid to put yourself out there. The only way to break through is to have that moment. I also think fear and success are connected in a way. It's sort of about mastering that. But anyway, I got off the ladder and I tasted the rock shrimp for the first time.
That rock shrimp dish is revelatory.
And, you know, you think about it, no one was doing food like that before. He is truly an original. So I called up Drew, who I knew.
Drew Naporant. Who was a partner and still is a partner in certain of the Nobu restaurants.
He's a partner in New York. And I said I'd love to. I heard Nobu's coming to New York. And Drew, I had just designed Vong for Jean-Georges Vongdenrichten, which was Thai. And Drew, in a moment of typecasting, said,
"Oh, you're the Asian food guy."
Yeah, exactly. I don't want it to look like Vong. And I said, "Well, that's not a problem. Not a problem." And then I met Robert De Niro, who for the first time, and then I met Nobu. And with Nobu, I went out and ate his food, interviewed him, and as I said, there was the fusion element, but there was also the fact that he articulated he didn't want it to feel like a traditional restaurant. And he wanted to have that sense of emotional connection that you get when you come in and see the sushi bar.
Wow. And so for you, that was like, oh, this is somebody I can work with.
That was the invitation. And he also talked about the fact that he was from the countryside, not the city, which is what led to the kind of abstract landscape in the original Nobu. So that research has led to now, 24 years later, a Nobu downtown at Fulton and Broadway, where every detail relates back to that backstory. So in some ways, it's like, talk about slow cooking. It's a restaurant that I had 24 years to think about.
Today's sponsor is RX Bar, a company that makes protein bars out of real food. No added sugar, no artificial colors or flavors, no preservatives, and no fillers. They're also gluten, soy, and dairy-free. In all 11 delicious varieties, you'll find simple ingredients, egg whites for protein, dates to bind, and nuts for texture. They're perfect for breakfast on the go, a snack at the office, an energy boost during a hike, and everything in between. Right now, RX Bar is offering 25% off your first order to all Special Sauce listeners. For this special deal, simply visit rxbar.com/SiriusEats and enter the promo code SiriusEats at checkout.
We are continuing our far-reaching conversation with the inimitable David Rockwell. Talk about the Nobu process just as a way to for people to understand how you go about doing something.
So the original Nobu, first of all, was in a space that had been many failed restaurants. I don't know if you remember, but it was a corner of Hudson and Northmore. Mm-hmm. It had these beautiful, still has these beautiful arch windows. We started to do the layout, and one of the things that clicked in very early on was how much of his food begins in the sushi bar and then is finished in the kitchen. So the sushi bar had to back up to the kitchen. Drew early on said he thought there did not need to be a bar there, a liquor bar, which was freeing in the sense that the central element could be the sushi bar. So as we laid that out, had it back up to the kitchen, I started to look at Japanese landscapes. And the plan of the original Nobu has three arcs, the arc of the back wall behind the sushi bar, and that was a glazed tile made by an artist named Elizabeth McDonald. Now, of course, today there's a gazillion online ways to find artists. In that case, there was a book called The Guild that was circulated.
That you could look through.
You could look through, and I found her work, so we commissioned her to do that. And the other part of the arc separates that private dining room with the side entrance. And then there were a series of trees that were inspired by birch trees. They were birch bark with blackened metal with branches.
Yes, I remember those.
Yeah. So we started to get a plan together and worked with Drew and Nobu on the plan. And then when it came to the sort of rest of it, it was a combination of colors that in some ways emphasize that combination of South American and Japanese food.
So it sounds like
Other important lesson I learned, you know, certainly Drew was an early mentor of this for me. It's important to think about what it's like if you're the first group in a restaurant. So if a restaurant seats 100 people, what is the view in for the first four people?
Interesting.
So you want a room that's flexible, but you don't want a room that reveals itself in such a kind of unfiltered way that the process of entering – I think the critical decisions in entering a restaurant are, first of all, what the entry experience feels like, how you transition from the street into the restaurant, and then how you move there and – you know, Drew certainly is a proponent of flexibility. Many architects doing restaurants, and I understand it and I feel this way to some extent, flexibility and coziness are in combat with each other, right? People want booths. They want to be against a wall. Flexibility means totally open. So that was one of the things we started to work out at Nobu with the booths along the window, which have really become an iconic piece of Nobu, those booths for four. Banquettes around the perimeter, but very open seating.
But that's the way you dealt with that tension.
That's right.
It's interesting that you talk about entrance to a restaurant because of course, my mind wanders to stage entrances. So were you trying to connect those worlds when you think about restaurant entrances?
Well, I didn't know it then, but many years later, I was asked to put together a talk for the TED conference. And the guy who was running it then, Richard Werman, said, why don't you speak about something that's a passion of yours that you love, but not something that promotes your work? And so I put together a talk on the relationship of theater and architecture. And it was the first time I started really delving into some of the details of that. And one of the main elements is, you know, in theater, entrance and proscenium is the way the story is introduced. When the curtain lifts and you're in that world, people come forward and tell you what that world is. That's what entering any space is.
Right. And you actually put curtains
at
Nobu.
We did.
But now I'm realizing that was not an accident.
Not an accident, but it wasn't a conscious relationship.
Got
to
it.
Theater. It was just It was just the things that interested me. The other thing that I find most intriguing about the relationship of theater and architecture is choreography, right? So in theater, the sets transform and move in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
In architecture, you meander through a space. So I was just in the Nobu downtown Friday night with some friends, and I was thinking about how different a room feels at seating height and standing height, at sort of movement or stationary. And I think restaurants very much exist on those two levels. I went to the Grill when it first opened up and had an extraordinary, maybe the best prime rib I've ever had. But, you know, that has such a carefully choreographed set of moves from entering downstairs, up the
right.
stairs.
Right. So the Grill is what the Four Seasons has become.
Right.
We should tell people. And this whole notion of choreography when it comes to restaurants is also interesting because I don't think about it, you know, how movement inside a restaurant actually contributes to the experience.
Yeah.
But is that something that you just came to realize was important, or it was just the way you connected the dots over time?
I just connected the dots over time. I was going to mention that before we moved to Mexico, we had a day in New York, a city day as kids, where we went to see, it was my first Broadway show, Fiddler on the Roof at the Majestic Theater.
Zero Mostel?
Herschel Bernardi.
Herschel Bernardi, got it.
And then we ate at my first New York City restaurant, which was Schraff's.
That's awesome.
And it is sort of amazing that many, many years later, those are two worlds that I continue to be interested in, find connections between the two worlds. Let me say something about theatrical, though, because I think theatrical sometimes is used in terms of design pejoratively, as in something looks theatrical. I think what's more interesting about theatrical is behaving theatrically, understanding there's a relationship between audience and performer. And of course, in a restaurant, you can switch off between being that audience and performer depending on where you sit.
Right. So the choreography in a restaurant is all about the transfer of energy.
Exactly.
Which obviously when you started getting into theater, which we'll get into, but one of the things that I think is the hallmark of what your company does and what you do is there are always these exquisite idiosyncratic details that are memorable. I remember the first time I walked into the original Nobu and was like, wow, what are those chopsticks doing on the back of the stools at the sushi bar?
I think it's fascinating when you think about what are the elements that create the memory. You know, what goes into creating those memories and what goes into avoiding bad memories? Because as an architect, there's many things in the design of a restaurant that you might not think about that actually help create memories that don't work. Like, is the kitchen so far from the table that the food gets there cold? Are the service stations organized in a way that if you're looking for someone, you know where to find them? Is the air conditioning set so that the vent is uneven and you're getting a draft? And so I think you have to start with all those infrastructure decisions. And then when you get those right, you can start to layer in elements that in some ways reinforce whatever the story is of the restaurant. You talk about a restaurant that is about pure energy transfer. We did the new Union Square Cafe for Danny.
Danny Meyer.
Union Square Cafe on 16th had been there for, I don't know how long, was it 30 years? A long time.
That was a seminal restaurant in Union Square.
Yeah. And when he asked if we would design it, we went back and walked through the space. And what was fantastic about it was the sense of hospitality. But there weren't design elements you really wanted to copy because, in fact, he didn't want a copy. I didn't want a copy. What we wanted was a place that took the energy of that place. And so we had to do a kind of experiential x-ray looking at things like the room was very episodic. Right, you walked in, there was a little vestibule. You came in, there were four tables on the right. You could step down to the left, or you could squeeze by the bar to the room in the back. So there was something about episodic that we knew we had to transfer.
Right. Like that it was a narrative arc that you had to.
It was a narrative arc. And, of course, the space for the new Union Square Cafe couldn't have been more different.
Right.
Right. We had this big soaring space.
Right.
As opposed to the
huge rectangle, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. So that was, really a extraordinary honor and an amazing opportunity for me and my team to work with Danny and his team on a weekly basis to think about how do you take a place that has a certain energy and that has a certain quality, but isn't really about the physical DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things, the color green, which we tweaked a little bit, but we used that color green. The artwork collection, we went back in time to all the artwork Danny and his team had there, and it was reframed and relit, and artwork became part of guiding the journey. So that was like a masterclass
in energy transformation from place to place.
Yeah, you can landmark a place. There are beautiful places that are landmark, Radio City Music Hall, but there are places where you wouldn't landmark the place, but you'd like to kind of note the experience. So that was a case where it was a sort of experience transfer.
Yeah. You were in the business of creating environments, but more than that, you're in the business of creating immersive experiences. I mean, how do you sort of wrap your head around a particular space when it comes to creating an immersive experience?
Well, every situation involves lots of research. It involves many, many, many layers of planning. And in fact, when Union Square Cafe was complete, we sent Danny a pile 6 inches thick of all the plans we looked at to get to the plan we ultimately settled on.
Wow.
But you have to draw on a body of experience. As a designer, you're constantly looking at the world around you and finding other relevant examples. It's trial and error. It's sketch models. It's understanding what the question is.
Mm-hmm.
With each restaurant, it's not just what's the solution, it's what's the question. And
You called one of your books What If.
Right, right. So it's a huge amount of experimentation and trial, and hopefully you end up in the right place.
Yeah. Well, I think more often than not, I think you have ended up in the right place. Well, wow, there's so many.
One of the things about Union Square Cafe that we uncovered that I think is interesting is since hospitality was such a big part of the experience, all the service stations in the new Union Square are the places that create the divisions between the rooms. So if you weren't looking for that, you wouldn't know that. But it's a big open space, but the floor plan is defined by groups of tables separated by service stations that are built as pieces of furniture that feel kind of iconic.
Wow.
So service actually is part of the
design. Yeah, and the layout. That's fascinating. Wow. You have to come back. Like, where did the time go? We haven't even gotten into theater stuff. I know you have to run, but will you come back so we can talk about your work in theater and hotels and all the amazing nonprofit and pro-social work you do?
I would love to do that. And I want to invite anyone listening to come to Central Park to Midsummer's Night Dream, which is happening through August 11th.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, David Rockwell.
Thank you.
To see the fruits of the David Rockwell Group's labor, you can walk into any Noble on the planet. You can stay in one of the hotels he's designed. You can go see a show on Broadway. And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. Thanks again, David. It was great.
Thank you.